The atomic age started with the dropping of a bomb. Let's all hope and pray that it won't end with the same event. The reaction of the President of the United States, Harry Truman, was that we've got to make a blessing out of this awful thing. And that began America's greatest public guilt trip, which has continued on through the decades. I think if you were not alive at that time, as I was, you would not fully appreciate the enormity of the genuineness of the guilt trip. I mean, rather than debating whether we should or shouldn't have dropped the bomb, no one wanted to talk about that at the time, but we were deluged with the most vivid descriptions of how this awesome power, this almost godlike power, would be turned to the use of the benefit of mankind. I think it's useful to examine some of the words that were said. For example, the Robert Hutchins, who was the chancellor of the University of Chicago, where a lot of the Manhattan Project research was done, said the following: from atomic energy, heat will be so plentiful that it will even be used to melt snow as it falls. A very few individuals working a few hours a day at very easy tasks in the general atomic power plants will provide all the heat, light, and power required by the community, and those utilities will be so cheap in their costs to hardly be made to matter at all. The science writer, Scripps Howards, in 45 said, all transportation forms will be freed at once from the limits now put upon them by the weight of present fuels. The privately owned airplane, now suitable only for cross-country hopping, will fly across the Atlantic. There would be no difficulty in building passenger and cargo airplanes of any desired size, and so on and so forth. They talked about filling the gasoline tank of your automobile rather than two times a week, once a year, with a pellet of atomic energy the size of a vitamin pill. The day will be gone when nations will fight for oil. Large pellets will be used to turn the wheels of industry, and then they do, they will turn the era of atomic energy into the age of plenty. And it went on and on and on, and people believed it. It was a euphoric era. Truth of the matter, at the same time, David Lilienthal, the head of the AEC, had to report to Harry Truman that about the time the Russians put off their bomb, that we had no stockpile. So if you read all through David Lilienthal's journals when he was head of the AEC, there was never any discussion of civilian nuclear power. They were in the arms race, and they were talking about the hydrogen bomb, and it was all about armaments, and all this talk about this idyllic world was just talk, and the very bright scientists that built the bomb, they went back to their secure positions in universities mostly, and they didn't get down and dirty with things like pipes and pumps and things like that that had to be developed for a reactor. It took Hyman Rickover, actually, who was a hands-on Navy guy working with a private company that developed the Nautilus, which was the first actual civilian application of nuclear power. And you have to remember that a submarine is always in water, so there was no problem of cooling water, and there was no problem of costs. He made it right, but the costs were just astronomical, and so the application had no validity to the civilian nuclear power program, but it did give people a basis for thinking that perhaps all these dreams about nuclear power had some validity to it. You know, So we went through this euphoric period that lasted through the 40s and into the 50s. And then we got into an era where the research wasn't producing anything. And frankly, the AEC people knew that they weren't anywhere near a civilian reactor, but they kept making all these grandiose promises in order to get money from the Congress to continue their weapons program, to be quite frank with you about it. And then events started happening. The Congress passed, the Price-Anderson Act in 1957, I think it was, which really was the beginning of the civilian nuclear power program. And they had some research reactors that didn't work out very well. No one paid much attention. But the big breakthrough was in 63, I think it was, when General Electric made a bid for the Oyster Creek nuclear power plant, and they bid at a price just under the price of coal. And, of course, the AEC and all these people hailed this as the beginning of the commercialization of nuclear power. Well, it was a loss leader bid, if there ever was one. The GE had no idea what that nuclear power plant was going to cost. All they decided as a corporation, it was time to start selling them. They had a turnkey deal at a price that made it competitive. But that price was way under what turned out to be the cost, and it ushered in the era of the cost overrun. And so these plants were built or sold at a price that looked like it was competitive with coal. But let's just understand this. There has never been a nuclear power plant built that was cost competitive in this country or anywhere else. It just had never happened. This is a technology whose middle name is cost overrun. And its last name and first name, too, if you want to be really honest about it. And so all of a sudden, what looked like a dormant option that had just gotten a lot of lip service began to be quite the rage. And, I can remember personally that I was had left the Federal Power Commission. I was in law practice in the mid-60s, and the General Electric Company came to my little law firm and asked us to help them figure out how to create a public power agency in New Jersey, because they wanted to build a half a dozen nuclear reactors right there on one site. Fortunately, the lawyers in GE said they'd be violating the antitrust laws and put a stop to it. But that was the mindset. It was so prevalent that a year later, the Peabody Coal Company came to our law firm and said that they were so afraid of nuclear power taking over the future, they didn't think the coal resources in the West would ever be developed, and they wanted to create public power agencies with low-interest money that could make the coal cheaper so they might have a chance of competing. Glenn Seaborg said, he didn't say it was probable, he said it was a certainty that nuclear power was going to be the wave of the future. And most people believed him. I personally found out how bad it was when I took over the Tennessee Valley Authority under Jimmy Carter in 76. I had found that TVA had stopped doing any maintenance work on its coal plants. For years, they were going all nuclear. They had an armada, I would call it, of about 12 nuclear reactors that they had built, and they were just writing off their coal plants. We put $1 billion into putting scrubbers and pollution control equipment on those coal plants. Then if we hadn't, TVA would have blacked out, because there were times in the future when all of their nukes were down. But anyhow, the mindset in those years was that this was the wave of the future. But mind you that there never was a single one of these nuclear power plants whose ultimate cost was anywhere near competitive with other sources of power. And the other thing to remember is that the old AEC had the dual role of being of promoting nuclear power. It's in the statute, as well as regulating it. And you know what took first place. It was the promotion. In fact, they suppressed all sorts of documents from their staff raising safety questions. So the issue of safety about nuclear power was not in the public domain as we went through this euphoric era in the 60s of just about everybody and their uncle ordering a nuclear power plant. At the same time, Glenn Seaborg, the head of the AEC, had gone to 60 different nations in the 50s. Remember the most famous speech of Dwight David Eisenhower as president was the Atoms for Peace speech he gave to the UN on December 8th, I think it was, 1953. And then as a result of that, we peddled the idea of the peaceful atom all over the world. And Seaborg was the main salesman. And I remember when the first time I went to Israel, and I asked them why, in the name of heaven, they were considering building an atomic power plant in the state of Israel. It would just be a Trojan horse. And I told them, and they said, well, Ben-Gurion told us that if you didn't have atomic energy, you weren't a modern nation. And that was really the mindset that we created. It was sold, it was made in America, it was sold by America all over the world. Now we face a new dilemma. Having sold the world on what supposedly was the peaceful atom, we find there ain't no such thing. That the road to the bomb is the nuclear power plant. And here we are in a confrontation with Iran and North Korea, who are just really implementing the program that America sold to the world. And how, in the name of common sense, can we expect the nations of the world to support us in trying to stop these countries from building bombs when we ourselves are promoting nuclear power? But it is the height of hypocrisy, and it's hypocrisy that I think we don't even have a mirror in which we see, because arrogance seems to have wiped out any mirror on our part. And you know, everybody that knows anything about it knows that not only can you enrich uranium a bit more and make a bomb, but you can reprocess the spent fuel, and the plutonium is the ingredients of the bomb. And this administration is actually trying to reverse Jimmy Carter's ban on reprocessing, so that we're in a situation where we don't see ourselves at all. But there has been one thing that has been constant throughout the whole era of nuclear power, is that it's never been economic. Never. Not then, not yesterday, not today, and not tomorrow. And what we're finding with the latest round of so-called new and improved versions, that the first thing you find out is there's a cost overrun of $1 billion or $2. And the big difference is this. 30 years ago, when we went on this nuclear binge, we did not have, it was the alternative source of power. Believe me, I remember receiving a petition from the Sierra Club back in the 60s advocating clean nuclear power in lieu of some dam that was being proposed in the West. But we did not have photovoltaic cells. We did not have wind power. We did not understand that you could store electricity when the sun shines and use it when the sun's not shining, etc. We did not have the alternative technologies that are truly sustainable and clean. And so we have a whole new situation on our hands. And quite frankly, I'm going to feel I'm old enough to conclude what I have to say with a kind of a Dutch uncle talk to us folks. I want to abolish sarcasm from the anti-nuclear movement. It doesn't help. It really doesn't. You know, there is a law of physics among human beings. If you insult somebody, they want to insult you back. It doesn't make them any smarter, and it doesn't persuade them one bit. It just persuades them that you're kind of goofy. And it hasn't made a difference. We've tried sarcasm and clown suits and stuff like that for 30 or 40 years, and it hadn't. The only impact it's made is to make us seem like we're a fringe group and make them seem like they're mainstream when it's just the opposite. It is true that this stuff is inherently the most fearsome thing on earth. But we don't talk about the part of it that I think most people can relate to the most. I mean, the average American, and I've been deeply involved in the fight against San Onofre, the average American thinks that a power plant that's been sitting there for 25 years and apparently hadn't hurt anybody, from what they could tell, nobody's really complained about it, isn't all of a sudden a killer. But I tell you what does impress people. When you tell them there's 30 years of radioactive trash that's piled up in their backyard and hadn't been taken care of, and we don't have any place to put it, that polls 75%. We've done some polling. People are more upset and afraid of the radio, and you need to call it radioactive trash. Nobody on earth knows what spent fuel is. With all due respect to my friend Alvarez and all the scientists that talk about this stuff, unless we start using plain English, we're talking to ourselves. Now, the stuff is radioactive trash sitting there in a swimming pool, and if they lose the water, you got a damn fire, the equivalent of a bomb. And we ought to be talking like that. I mean, fear is a pretty strong factor. And people really relate to the idea that we don't have any place to put this stuff. And you tell them that it's been 50 years and they haven't figured out a safe place to put it. It does suggest that we might even get a majority of people in this country in favor of birth control, controlling the birth of more radioactive trash because we don't know where to put it. And that is the strongest argument that I've been able to find to persuade people that we ought to shut down the nuclear reactors that are operating because it is immoral. I think, and a lot of people will agree with that, it is immoral to make more stuff that you don't know what to do with and just let it sit there for future generations to deal with. And no one has ever talked about the cost of just monitoring this trash for a million years. I realize that on a present value basis in the world of economics, that nothing 30 years from now is worth anything, but most people don't really believe that. And I don't think we put enough emphasis on the fact that we should not be making more of this stuff, and the stuff that we have, we need to put it into dry concrete casts and leave it where it is. Because the idea that there is some place somewhere that is safe ignores anything that knows anything about geology and the fact that the earth just changes all the time. It's a way of taking the stuff out of sight and out of mind, and it's kind of like putting dirt under your carpet at home. It doesn't remove it. It just hides it, and then you don't even see it, and you don't know when it's going to bite you. So I think that the cost issue, radioactive trash issue, are the ones that really we can hammer home. And we have to first recognize that we have lost the movement. We are a few patriotic souls here that get together every once in a while and say the same things to each other over and over again. But there is no anti-nuclear movement in this country today. We have lost connection with the American people. Three Mile Island killed the nuclear industry for 20 or 30 years, but it is not dead, and there's 150 reactors lying all over the country as radioactive sleeping dogs that can erupt if there's an earthquake or a human accident. And thus far, we're seeing one of these things about every 10 years, and there's no reason to think that that cycle is going away. But we're not winning the argument on the safety issue of the plant, and I don't think we'll win it all by itself. There's an old expression that says that you can't beat something with nothing. And too much of our verbiage is negative and anti. We need to form a very, very strong 100% renewable movement in this country and get together and let people know that we don't have to choose between carbon and plutonium. We can damn well get rid of both. And to the extent that we're not doing that, we're just, I think, not wasting time, but we're just beating our head up against the same wall over and over again. There is no excuse. If we can't persuade the rest of the environmental movement, we can't hope to persuade the country as a whole. If we can't unite the folks that claim to be for the environment to the fact that the nuclear issue is an existential threat to the man and womankind just as great as climate change. I've been at this for 40 years. I have been unable to make a distinction that one is any more awesome or any worse. They're both the most horrible threats that mankind faces. But the beauty of it is that we have an alternative, namely 100% renewable, that get rid of both of them, and we are not, as a group, organized to put our emphasis on making the positive case. There's a much better chance of persuading the American people to be for something than to just be against. And we haven't persuaded folks that there is a 100% renewable alternative to both coal and nuclear. It's out there. There have been books written about it. Arjun Makajani's written a book on it. I've written a book on it. Everybody knows that it can be done. But somehow or another, we are now all into our little tunnel visions where we're focused on, you know, and I don't want to diminish any of the scientific studies they've been doing, but every scientist can also be a spokesperson. I mean, the world has to count on people with knowledge to not just do their doctoral papers, but to speak out and to speak to laymen and other people. I mean, I just think that there needs to be a pledge made by everybody in this room that before you go to another anti-nuclear movement, you will have had 10 people over for coffee in your particular place of living and talk to them about this issue. Because we're not going to get anywhere just meeting and meeting and meeting and telling ourselves how great we are and how worthy we are and how strong we are when we have a Democratic president who is pro-nuclear and not hearing very much about it from anyone. So I do think that I'm an optimist. I'm an optimist because while Glenn Seaborg was talking about taking atomic energy to go to the moon, it was solar-powered PV cells that took us to the moon. And while these folks talk about their technology, it's the solar and the wind and the possibility for storage that has made the breakthroughs. They are cost-effective now, and many states are requiring that they be implemented. And I think that if we spend 10 words advocating 100% solar for every word that we spend trying to scare people about things they're not scared about, but let's talk about that radioactive trash and let's hammer home the fact that every nuclear power plant raises your electric rates and try to see if we can't get a young female version of Ralph Nader to take the lead here, then we might win.
Thank you very much. That was wonderful. Apropos of what we've heard at this conference, including this morning and this afternoon, maybe in addition to what you were talking about, if it does turn out that Fukushima is resulting or has resulted in hypothyroidism in infants, I don't think the public would like that very much. And also, if studies could show that they're eating radioactive food. I think that could help persuade them that renewables are the way to go. Now, we have one more speaker, and in this session, actually, I was going to introduce him as the final speaker on the program, but then I remembered that later on there's somebody else, I think it's a woman named Caldicott, who's going to have something to say. It's a pleasure to introduce Dr. Herbert Abrams, who is a professor at Stanford University, and he is going to talk about the hazards of low-level radiation, controversy, and evidence. Dr. Abrams?
Ladies and gentlemen, and Mr. Moderator, and Helen Caldicott, thanks to you very much for this extraordinary two-day meeting in which I've learned a great deal. I think maybe David Freeman should really be the cleanup speaker on this because he's gotten the message across. So I'm going to just... So let me just emphasize... How am I going to do that? Yeah. Now, can you hear me in the back? There's been an interesting precept that not long ago we were hearing that if living conditions didn't stop improving in this country, we were going to run out of humble beginnings for our great men. And life was said to be easier than we thought. All that we had to do was accept the impossible and do without the indispensable and bear the intolerable. So I think we can agree that life is not just one damn thing after another. It's one damn thing over and over. Kim Hubbard perhaps put it the best. The world gets better every day and then worse again by evening. Othello says it is the very era of the moon. She comes more near the earth than she was wont and makes men mad. The moon on course, a source of moonbeams and moonlight and moonshine. The moon off course, a push to moonquakes and moonscapes and madness. A wonderful metaphor for all of dual-use technology. Radiation as the prime example. It can diagnose cancer, it can treat cancer, but it also creates it. So I've been asked to talk a little bit about the BEIR7 report in terms of process and product. Is that okay? And the report came out a few years ago. I was a member of the committee for 6 years, and it was surely an interesting experience. And it represents the latest in a series begun in 1972. You've heard a lot about it these last 2 days, and rightfully so. And some of my material I'll move along fairly quickly. It was created to convey the level of risk of ionizing radiation, and it's widely accepted as a source of reasonable material. So this is really what we'll be getting to. We started this committee with wide representation, with experts from the U.S. and from Canada, from France, from the U.K., from Holland, and they represented epidemiology, genetics, radiology, physics, cancer biology, radiation biology, biostatistics, science and risk communication. And there were many different witnesses during the course of our meeting, and that was part of the purpose, really, in the sense that the Congress had mandated openness of the sessions. At times, things got a little confrontational as the industry groups, the activists, and the self-involved took center stage. And passions ran high because to some, the stakes seemed high. If the report affected policy, larger risk estimates and lower permissible doses might follow. With lower estimates, a relaxation of protection standards might be in the air. You all know that in 1947, the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission was created in Hiroshima. Later, it became the Radiation Effects Research Foundation, and its purpose was to document and to understand the long-term effects of exposure. The original lifespan study of 120,000 survivors and the adult health study of 25 continued over a 65-year period until today. And as you've heard time and time again, they provide powerful evidence for evaluating cancer risk from radiation. This is the building of the Radiation Effects Research Foundation in Hiroshima. It's supported by the United States and by Japan. It has 400 scientists working away on a great variety of projects. And during one of my visits there, the visit was occasioned by the sense of a congressman that we were spending money fruitlessly on this project abroad. And so an international committee was created, of which I was a member. We spent a week there looking at all of the projects, and we were able to come up with the recommendations that this was one of the great and unreproducible epidemiology studies that the planet had ever seen. And so the funding continued. The survivors were widely distributed by age. In 1995, 44,000 still survived, and by 2020, there'll still be 14,000 alive, and all of them will be under the age, will have been under the age of 20 when they were exposed. So this period is going to be a quite important one. So you can ask, why low-level radiation? And one of the answers is that because the harmful effects of large and medium doses have been amply demonstrated over time, we have not been able really to come up with certainty in the past about the effects of exposure at low levels. They've been more difficult to document. And part of that is that the use of the term goes all over the map. This is a chart that I created for our BIR 7 committee, and in it I have noted 19 different estimates, all of them with low-level radiation, in the title of the paper and all in referee journals, with a range of a few hundred times between top and bottom, from 3,000 millisieverts down to 20 millisieverts, and all of them called low-level radiation. Well, we came up with our own definition, which was derived from a consensus of the committee and the outside reviewers, and that was levels up to 100 millisieverts, the lowest doses with relevant data that were available. I won't go into, I think you're all aware that a sievert equals 100 rem in the old terminology, 1 joule of energy per kilogram, but millisieverts, as we know, are a very common measure of radiation energy deposited in living tissue. And 100 roughly equal 10 rads or rems in the older terminology. That's about 30 to 40 times our annual background of 3 millisieverts, and it's 10 times out of a CAT scan and 1,000 times that of a chest X-ray. 65% of the atomic bomb survivors received a low dose, that is to say, at or below 100 millisieverts, as best the dose symmetry could be achieved. So most of the radiation that we're exposed to comes from our natural background, air, food, outer space, the Earth, radon gas as a major source. That comprises 82%, and this is clearly the same diagram that you saw before, whereas 18% is related to man's intervention. And of that, tap water, tobacco, building materials, and medical X-rays and nuclear medicine are the largest element. Here you see this in a pie shape, broken up. And the important note to make is that over 300 million medical X-rays are performed every year, and over 120 million dental X-rays. And the CAT scans, as you know, have been contributing a good deal of the high-dose diagnostic examinations. The average annual effective dose is 50 millirems or 0.5 millisieverts. But some of the exposures are much higher. That is to say, a GI tract or angiography or interventional radiology, and those range up into a level of 8 millisieverts or sometimes even more. CAT scans have been used, as I said, a lot, and sometimes they've been used sequentially. And a big worry here is their use in young people when there's something that's being followed, because the cumulative dose can get quite high. When they are performed repetitively over the years, it's been calculated that they increase the cancer mortality risk by almost 1 in 50. So radioisotope exams are also very common, as well as being a source of rather large doses. You can see the cardiovascular and the brain studies, 14 millirem, 12 millirem, or 12 or 14 millisieverts in our present language. But it's got to be clear that we're all exposed. Exposure increases the risk of developing radiation cancer. As far as the mechanism is concerned, it's complicated. There's damage to DNA that's been talked about, single and double strand breaks and oxidative changes in the nucleotide bases. And then the DNA deletions and the gene and chromosome damage begin the process whereby cancers are produced. And so what were the conclusions that the committee came to? And one that was crystal clear was that the linear non-threshold model of cancer risk prediction was validated by the committee. There was no evidence of a threshold below which no cellular damage occurs. And more importantly than that, significant lifetime risks were shown. We know that high radiation doses tend to kill cells, lower doses to damage the genetic code. The higher the dose, the sooner the effects of radiation will appear. As far as the model, here you see the straight line, linear no threshold model, and it is by far the best working model that has been achieved thus far. What about the excess risk? 12 cancers, including lung, liver, breast, prostate, stomach, colon, thyroid, and leukemia. And the excess risk, if you look, for example, at breast, it's almost 100%, but for others, it's well over the 50% level. The number of excess cases of cancer from exposure to 100 millisieverts at the age of 30 and then an attained age of 60, 800 in females, these are rough figures, 1,300 in females. And this substantiates what you've heard earlier in the afternoon about the differential in production of tumors in males and females. Since our report, there have been a number of important epidemiologic studies. And the 15-country study in particular, in 2006, 446,000 nuclear workers and clear evidence of an increased level of cancer deaths at the 1 to 2% level. Elizabeth Cardis in France conducted this, but with the collaboration of many others as well. The Teka River study is an example of where a contaminated river full of the waste from the Maya nuclear production firm caused a clear increase in cancer risk, 3%. And then the UK study, that should be 175,000 nuclear workers, in which, again, protracted radiation with a higher risk. And the last one I'm going to mention is the combined post-2002 study of 12 epidemiologic studies that really confirm the basic conclusions of the BEIR 7. Now, we can look to this difference in related mortality for women, 37.5% higher than for men. Infants, as compared to adults, 3 to 4 times the cancer risk, with female infants having almost double the risk of males. There are countervailing approaches, such as hormesis, which you have heard discussed, interest in the bystander effect, adaptive responses, which we know have been documented, genomic instability. But the one observation that there is total concurrence in is that all of the figures that are produced are subject to a certain level of uncertainty. So, low doses, and this is really in conclusion, low doses increase the risk, but it's not a very huge risk. It's a definite one. As lifetime exposure increases, the risk itself goes up. There will be one excess cancer in 100 individuals, but there will also be a large number of so-called naturally occurring cancers as well. And that's been one of the great problems with radiation epidemiology, that is to say, the difficulty of extracting the signal from the noise. While high levels of radiation exposure may increase the likelihood of heart disease or the risk of heart disease, that no impact of the low levels that we studied could be found, and we were unable to determine the presence of genetic effects in the offspring of ABOM survivors, which is kind of in contrast to the animal studies, which showed that increased cellular mutations in animals can be passed on to their offspring. So, this was a balanced and thoughtful committee. There was a lot of expertise in a lot of different areas. There was a good bit of controversy. There was one member who clearly did not believe, at least at the outset, that low doses of radiation had any ill effects on human subjects. But the discussion kept going, and the witnesses were a major element in the ability to develop a consensus. So I started out with the moon, but I end up with a Chinese proverb, "A star, however willing, cannot help the moon, and 1,000 stars are not equal to 1 moon." So we never have all the answers. And I must say, one of our faculty has been so imbued with research that he sent 2 of his children to Sunday school and kept the other 2 home as controls. But he still doesn't have the answers. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, if we can get the other panelists up here. I'll pose the first question. What about small nuclear reactors pushed as the future for the industry?
Well, we tried them to begin with, and they went to large ones because the small ones cost too much. Now the large ones cost too much, so they're going to small ones. They're in a circle chasing themselves, and they're going to wear themselves out.
All right. This is for Dr. Abrams. Do you see a correlation between use of mammography and the epidemic of breast cancer?
The answer is definitely yes, but not the way the questioner anticipated. Mammography is a good detection system, even though it's got a lot of false positives. And what's happened clearly is that it is now detecting more breast cancers. If you look at the absolute mortality of breast cancer in this country over the last decade, and the figures come from the government, it's relatively flat. But a lot more have been shown, and therefore there's many of them have been caught early. But as all of you know, there's a continuing controversy about the efficacy of mammography, and it boiled up just 2 weeks ago in the New England Journal of Medicine when there were a series of responses to a paper, and one of them said that mammography causes breast cancer, and another one said that with mammography you can really get cures. And the third one said, hey, look, talk to your doctor about it.
Okay, for David Freeman, renewable energies have the potential to change an energy system into a decentralized democratic generation and supply. Maybe. How can we convince the legislature to move away from the paradigm of energy monopolies?
Well, I would respond to that person that we need all the renewable energy we can get, whether it's on the rooftops of homes, the sides of buildings, the bathroom, or anywhere else, and including the deserts. What really bothers me is that these debates among elements of the renewable energy, you never hear a coal company attacking an oil company. You never hear the fossil fuel industries anything but a united front. Here we are at the beginning stages, and frankly, the idea that the technology can take on the job of replacing most of the money in this country and then take on the job of reforming our government at the same time, they teach you in trying to make things happen to take on one big problem and hammer it home. Now, I'm a great believer in decentralized power sources, but we're not going to replace these coal plants and these nuclear plants unless we put some large solar power plants in the deserts on land that is not suitable for anything else. And large wind farms. I mean, there are places in Wyoming where you can have 3,000, 4,000 megawatts of wind power. We've got to harness all the renewable sources, and whether in the process we help democracy, that's wonderful, and I think it will. But to make that your central goal and say we just want decentralized sources, I just don't think that we're going to win the fight. Frankly, it takes about as long to put a solar panel on a roof as it does to lay out 200 megawatts in the desert. And we need both. But we need to be sure that we pick the spots in the desert that are not national forests. You don't want to put a transmission line through a national forest or pick a fight with a Joshua tree that you're going to lose. But part of the problem, and not just to be blunt about it, is the environmental movement is kind of like us old people protecting every penny of Medicare. I mean, there are a lot of NIMBYs in the world that are opposed to transmission lines just because they don't want anything in their neck of the woods. Now, we're not going to have 100% renewable unless we build some transmission lines to where the solar and the wind is concentrated. And we need the NIPA, and CEPA, all those environmental laws need to be tougher to say no to a bad project quicker, but also to say yes to a good project quicker. And, you know, the laws that were passed in the 70s under Richard Nixon need to be revised a bit to suit. Nobody ever dreamed that you'd use the National Environmental Policy Act to stop a solar or a wind farm. It was designed to stop polluting plants. And the lawyers, and I'm one of them, have expanded its reach to where, I mean, I was in charge of the Port of Los Angeles, and just to expand and modernize the port, we had to spend 3 years on environmental impact statements. And it was only to say yes after 3 years. You know, it's time that we recognize that we are a slight drag ourselves on the pace at which these renewable energy projects are being built and face up to that part of it. And we cannot marry the renewable revolution to every other issue that we have and expect to win with it.
We better leave that there. That's a nice comprehensive answer.
I have three quick parts to that. The first one is elect Russ Feingold to the Senate again. That's an answer. And the second one is every single open parking lot in the country. And if you look to Martha's Vineyard, you'll see it in the grocery covered with solar panels. And the third one is that the wind machines in the offshore area of the Vineyard and Nantucket, that's going right ahead.
Okay, good. For Cindy Folkers, I think I'd like a discussion to recent changes in allowable radiation in U.S. food and water.
Is this pertaining to FDA or EPA, does it say?
It's just in general as to whether there have been recent changes in allowable radiation.
Well, I tell you what has changed. I don't know about the allowable limits because FDA is the target of what we're trying to do, but I do know that the NRC has raised the background amount of radiation that we supposedly get to, I believe it's 620 millirem a year, which is very, very high. It's been that way a year and a half now, 2 years, I can't remember. Spring of 2010. And that really shocked me. They raised it after Chernobyl. This was before Fukushima, but that includes radon, which not everyone is exposed to, and it includes medical exams, which some people do not get. And they're taking that and they're averaging it across the entire population and saying this is what people get. So that doesn't directly answer the question because I don't know. There are lots of regulations and lots of agencies handle. There are lots of regulations and lots of agencies handle these regulations. And they'll change things and you won't know it for years. Or there'll be conflicts between what EPA wants and what FDA wants. It's very, very difficult to tease out at any one time who's in charge of which regulation as far as contamination goes.
Well, when are we likely to know how much radiation there is in the fish we buy?
Never.
That long?
Well, if I had my druthers, it'd be, you know, within 6 months. But this is the process. The FDA will take a number of months to look at what our request is, and we're considering it a collaborative effort right now. And we can only go.